obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is Rich Brucker. I'm an alcoholic. I was separated from alcohol on August the 30th. 04. And on that day, I didn't quit drinking. I didn't put the plug in the jug. My best thinking didn't bring me to you. None of those things I've sometimes heard in meetings, you know, are true. As a matter of fact, I think that aside from just making me arrogant, if I said those things, they would also make me non-alcoholic. Because they would employ, you know, they would just imply that I had some type of power, choice, and control over to drink. You know, today I'm just going to not drink and go to AA. I'm going to just put the plug in the jug and enough's enough. You know, I'm going to draw the line here. This is it. You know, and I have this great idea. What I'm going to do is just not drink. And, you know, that's just not what happened. On August the 29th, I was drunk as a monkey. And on August the 30th, I didn't have to take a drink all day. And there's no step in our book. There's no paragraph. There's nothing that talks about that. But we talk about it all the time, and we have this weekend. I've heard some great members of Alcoholics Anonymous speak all weekend in every room, and I thank everyone, every member that came before me. I'll leave a better man for having been here this weekend, that's for sure. And I like that. What I heard was good members this weekend. I'm not a big fan of that term speaker because I know a lot of these folks, and I've been to their groups, and I see what they do. And what they are is just another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And although a lot of them are my teachers, and it's been really neat for me to be in your ranks and to be with you because you're my friends and people that send me emails in the morning and people that I can bounce heart questions off of, and you steer me through life in a way that I know you love me and I'm willing to listen. And that's a rarity. You're about to hear that. And what I guess your job to listen for, I'm clear on my job. There's a guy, while the term enlightened alcoholic just sounds goofy, those words don't go together. There is a, you know, a couple people that I think, you know, came close to certain things. I dig this guy, Ernie Kurtz. He wrote a book called The Spirituality of Imperfection. And in that book, in rooms right now all around this town and many others, there's people talking about God in a certain way. They're telling you what he looks like and what you should read and how you should pray. And they're talking at and about God. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, Kurtz says, we don't do that in that book. And as a matter of fact, he says, one of the reasons that AA works so well is that all we do is we tell stories. And in those stories, we see God. So I'm going to tell you all the story of what God has done in and through my life. And in that story, I hope you're clear on what you're to be listening for. And I grew up in a wonderful family in Baltimore. Mother and father, little sister, 3 years younger. Nobody in my family drinks. No grandparents, no aunts, no uncles. Any genetic theories of alcoholism, right on, if that's what you think. Our book says that we as a fellowship have no opinion on how one becomes alcoholic. If you're one of those folks that stood up as new, counting days or months, I hope you don't waste as much time as I did trying to figure out, you know, how in the world I became alcoholic. I've always liked the story of, it's like a guy whose house is burning to the ground. And I mean, my whole, everything in that house, everything valuable is just burning to the ground. And the fire department's there. They've ran the hose from the hydrant. You all are there, my neighbors. You're out front coaching me, cheering for me. Rich, shoot the hose. Shoot the hose. Put the fire out. Please, shoot the hose. I mean, it's burning to the ground. But the problem is I'm up in front. I control the hose. And you know what? I'm going, well, wait a second. Before I shoot this hose, we need to figure out how this fire started. You know? And what could be less important than how the fire started when we have everything you need right here to put the fire out? And with... With that said, my sponsor, I've had two. My first was a man named Jim. Jim had a sponsor by the name of Clarence Snyder. He had a sponsor by the name of Dr. Bob Smith. I just tell you that because I like to know where I got it, what I got it from, you know. And I hope that's not to impress anybody. I just hope you know who your sponsor is and who their sponsor is and where they got it from. I've been working with a guy named Roger, and Roger said he thinks I'm alcoholic because I drank too much. Don't waste any more time, Rich. That's why I think you're alcoholic. And I said, okay, and I've just kind of gone with that. So if you're new, that might be it. You drank too much. So welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Think no more on that. In Baltimore, they do that thing. The school buses have a social hierarchy. The older kids sit in the back of the bus, the younger to the front. I don't know if they do that here. If you go to the back of the bus, you get beat up. The school assigned me a very special guy. His name was Reed. Reed's job was just to beat me up every day for something. He'd figure it out. There was also a girl on that school bus. Her name was Nikki. Nikki looked like a lot of you women here this weekend. She was something else. And I didn't know how to talk to Nikki. I didn't know how to ask her out. I got nothing. I got nothing. And this is at this school I go to, and up to third grade, I went to a public school, and then my parents are hard-working, blue-collar folks. I lived on a little horse farm, and in the morning I had chores, feeding the horses, mucking the stalls. And then my parents' big crime in my life, looking back through inventory, was they took me out, they saved up. Here's what they did to me. They saved up all their money so that they could take me out of a public school and offer me a better education than was ever available to them. You guys aren't feeling the same way about this that I did. I mean, I hated them for the next decade for this. You know, my perception was, you ripped me away from my friends. You put me on this school bus. There's a 45-minute bus ride each way. The rich kids make fun of me. They call me farm boy, redneck. I mean, why would you do that to a kid? You know, but I don't know how to verbalize that. I don't have any steps. I just start my path of the world versus me, right? And on that school bus one day, I always had this thing, you know, hanging with the older kids. I don't know what that was all about. I just liked it. Some of the older kids said, you want to skip last class and do you want to do some drinking? And I believe I was in sixth or seventh grade, but I couldn't swear to it. And I said, you bet, like I'd been doing it all along. I'd never skipped any class. I'd never had a drink. And they said, what do you drink? And I said, bourbon. And I don't know where I got that from. And I wish I got to tell you that that's what we had, because that would be kind of manly, you know. And this is how, if you're new, you know that, you know, I didn't know I was going to be in AA, because I'd have a better story. What I'm about to tell you is so lame. I mean, what those guys had wasn't bourbon. It was peach schnapps. And I know, it's just so weeny, you know. But what I know makes me one of you isn't what I drank or how often I drank it or what it did to me, as we've heard talked about all weekend. It's what it did for me that makes me one of you. Alcohol does to the human body the same thing for everybody, alcoholic or not. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic, they'll get sick. It's called alcohol poison. Alcohol is a poison. You put enough in the human body gets rid of it. Doesn't make you alcoholic. That's just one of the things alcohol does to me. You put enough alcohol in somebody, anybody. You put them behind the wheel of a car enough times, they'll get a DUI. That's just the odds of people versus police, right? Eventually, you're going to get pulled over, get a DUI or one or two. It doesn't necessarily make you alcoholic. You put enough alcohol in a non-alcoholic for a long enough period of time and stop abruptly, that person will shake and sweat and twitch and go through all the early parts of the DTs. Doesn't necessarily make, that's just what alcohol does to the human body. But what it does for me, that's what makes me one of you. And the incredible thing is what I'm willing to let it do to me in exchange for what it does for me. And as they're passing that peach schnapps around, and I'm there with those older guys skipping that class, man. First thing I noticed, I'm like, man, these guys are as lucky to be hanging out with me as I am with them. And I'd never felt like that my whole life. Yeah. And then I went into the bathroom. It said boys on the door. That struck me funny because, you know, for the first time in my life, I sort of felt like a man with that stuff in me. And I'm in the boys' room feeling like a man. And this thought goes through my mind about Nikki on that school bus. And somehow I intuitively knew how to handle this situation that used to baffle me. And I come out of the boys' room feeling like a man. I start walking to the back of the school bus where I know I don't belong. Reed gets up out of his seat to give me my daily beating. In his defense, he wasn't all the way to his feet. He was getting up. And as he did, I gave him everything I had, and Reed went down and out, and he was out cold, and the whole school bus got really, really quiet. And I sat down next to Nikki, and I'm looking at Nikki. Nikki's looking at me. I'm looking at Nikki. And this feeling that some of you will remember, like long overdue respect, you know, came over me. And it felt good. And then we got to Nikki's bus stop. And she leaned over and she gave me a little kiss that was different than my aunts or my mother had ever given me. It was like half on the lips and half on the cheek. Some of you guys will remember that first one. I don't know if you'll cop to it, but I mean, I felt it in my toes. It just went. And when we got to my bus stop, I got off and I went into that nice house with those parents with morals, integrities, values, a whole lot of wonderful stuff. They taught a whole lot of love in that house, and I was obviously drunk. And they left me in the bathroom getting sick all night long of that peach schnapps, you know, and they left me in there, you know, to teach me a lesson. And that was going to become a theme in my life. And an alcoholic of my variety, you know, I don't necessarily catch on to these lessons that I'm supposed to be being taught, right? And I wake up and my neck is kinked up next to the toilet. You know how we sleep in the just unhuman positions. And I was just sick as a dog. And it turned out that then they came in with the punishment. I was grounded forever, you know. And that's like life without parole for you prison guys, you know, when you're in like seventh grade. And I just remember thinking, man, God, I feel horrible, horrible. Sick as a dog, grounded forever. Are you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You bet. Are you kidding me? Sick as a dog and grounded forever. You know, what a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus with Nikki. You know? And what I didn't know, and I can't say it any better than Bill, my relationship with alcohol was set in flight much like a boomerang. And while that boomerang was going out, it gave me so much for so long until one day it would turn in flight and nearly shred me to ribbons. And alcohol was going to take from me, or I was going to surrender to it, whichever way you like to phrase it, every bit of morality, every bit of integrity, every bit of decency those wonderful parents gave me. And it was going to happen so slowly, and I was going to give them over so slowly that I didn't even know I was doing it. I was going to give them over one drink at a time. You know, and our book talks about by the time the alcoholic me catches on, that I'm often the last to know. You guys could see it long before I can. But by the time I catch on to what's going on and what alcohol's, you know, doing to me and for me and that ratio that's going on, that I've slipped past this point of human aid. And I'm the last to know. And I drank as much as I could through high school. We do a lot of cornfield drinking in Maryland when you're underage. You get a, build a fire, you get a keg of beer. You drink in the field. I'm driving a CJ7 at one point, Jeep with the narrow wheelbase, no doors, no roof. I got a keg in the back. Also the type of, wherever I'm drinking, I know that there's a better party somewhere else. I'm not a good stationary drinker. embarrassingly, I also seem to think, looking back, that drinking and driving was like a recreational sport. And we're at the bonfire. It's time to go. We load the keg up. I got that keg in the back. Four or five friends piled into that Jeep, and I came around a turn too fast, and that Jeep rolled three or four times into the cornfield. Everybody fell out. There's broken bones and scrapes, but nobody's seriously injured. And that may capture the attention of an average or, you know, even a hard drinker, maybe. You know what I think? We land after that thing rolls, and I think, whew. Did you see that? That was some good drunk driving right there. I mean, that was like NASCAR stuff. I mean, that thing rolled three times. Boom, I landed on my feet. We all walked away. I'm a good drunk driver. You know, and embarrassingly, there has been many times on a bar stool where that conversation has been discussed about why I'm a good drunk driver. If you've ever uttered those words, I welcome you. And then I usually follow it with a series of sentences, you know, some kind of drunk driving theory, a system really is what it was. You know, and I explain to you why I drive, say this sentence, and I mean it. I drive better drunk than sober, right? And then I tell you why. Well, because what you do is you put the windows three quarters of the way down, you light a cigarette in case you get pulled, they smell the smoke, not the liquor, you get the radio going, you get your right arm propped up, the left arm stays on the window, it creates an arm of resistance, so you keep the wheel straight, close the right eye, lock the left eye on the yellow line, right? And we all go through this, and you're laughing because if you had one of those, if you're in this room and you had a system for drunk driving, you know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know that normal people have a system for drunk driving. I'm getting in trouble. I'm getting arrested on weekends in high school. My parents are leaving me in jail for the weekend, right, to teach me a lesson. and that goes right past me. All that is to me is it's a better story on Monday morning at that nice private school, as if I needed to earn like some street cred, right, with the little rich kids. Like, guess what? I was in jail all weekend. And that progresses all through. I'm getting in more and more trouble around drinking. I eventually get to go. God gave me a couple of things that I now know are absolute gifts as opposed to anything I've earned or deserved or worked for or anything like that. If I read something, it sticks in my mind forever. I could tell you what page it's on and roughly what paragraph. Turns out that that's a very good skill for the way that we do school in the United States. I could read it and spit it right back at you. My sponsor would, you know, be remiss if he didn't point out that as far from being smart or having any ability to learn or comprehend, it's just but it's tricky, you know. When you're young, it kind of I'm getting straight A's and I can remember stuff, and I was a good athlete, so I got to go play soccer. I had two requirements for looking for a college to go to. I wanted to be as far away from those wonderful parents with their morals and values and all that terrible stuff. I wanted to be as far from home as I could, and I wanted to be able to surf, because I've been surfing since I can't remember, before I can remember learning. And so I picked the University of San Diego. I came out here to go to USD, little school. They offered, you know, nice scholarship. I overlooked one small factor, that they're a Jesuit school. I had no idea what Jesuits were. Now I'm going to class, drinking as much as I can. We got morning and evening practices. I'm a quick observer, like we've heard discussed. I could figure out very quickly what it takes to fit in with a group of people, right? If I'm at the Grateful Dead concert, I'm a hippie and we're doing a hippie dance, and right, you know, and if I'm at a heavy metal concert, we're rocking, and if I'm with the biker guys, I'll get some leather on, you know, like whatever it is, right? So at USD, it appeared to me that the formula was the rich guys, guys that have some stuff, get the chicks. And I noticed that because, like, BMWs were going up and down between the palm trees, and the guy driving them usually had a pretty girl next to him. And that set me on a mission much like Bill, you know, into the realm of the material. I was going to have to acquire some stuff. I had some other things happening at that school. I was assigned a lady called an academic advisor. Now, that might sound kind of neutral to you, but it didn't to me. Her job was just to help me pick classes that maybe I'd graduate in 4 years. That's it. And when I've looked back through inventory, there's been a lot of people like this lady in my life, that they're just well-meaning people trying to give me a friendly nudge and a bump along the road of life towards having a happy and successful life. But something inside of me, the type of alcoholic I am, when I've looked back, there's been so many well-meaning people trying to help me along the road of life, and I don't perceive it that you're trying to help me. Anybody that's ever tried to help me, I think you're trying to hurt me. You're trying to tell me how to live my life. Back off. This is my life. Let me live it. And I don't know what that's all about, but that sure is how I saw it. And she said, we need to get some other things on your resume that make it look like, you know, you care about other, you do something other than like go to school and play soccer. And she said, we've had an idea here for a long time about getting an office of alcohol and drug education started on campus. We want to start a program called Campus Connections. It's going to be a peer counseling program, students counseling. We want to get a student, you know, certified as an alcohol and drug counselor to help other students. And, you know, we want you, Rich, to be the guy, the founding father of the office of alcohol. This is going to look really good on your resume. And I don't know about you all, but I understand looking good on paper. I don't much like living that way, but I get the concept, right? You're going to have to look good on paper. And that's what happened. So now my day's getting busy. I also fall in. There's four other guys on that soccer team that are on scholarship, and they're from just across the border from Tijuana. And really good soccer players. They also have a lot of cousins, like 38 cousins each. And these cousins know how to get the green stuff that the rich kids like smoking. So that starts happening, because I'm going to need to get some stuff. Now my day's filling up. I got office hours at night, you know, and here's what my day starts to look like. I got, you know, morning practice, Jesuit classes, come home, afternoon practice, got to eat some food, drink a little bit, because, you know, now's the worst part of my day. From 7 to 10 p.m., I have to counsel you pathetic folks with your alcohol problem. And, you know, by the way, if anybody needs to take the edge off, just come see me after office hours. We'll get you squared away. And then I got to drink a lot to fall asleep, because you know, if your life was like my life, I'm very busy, I got a lot going on. And what our book says is that the alcoholic often lives a double life. And if I'd have just had two going on, that would have been great. But if any two people in my life had talked or been in the same place at the same time, there would have been big trouble. If, you know, my mother had talked to my little sister about the different stories I was putting out, there would have been trouble. If my mother had talked to the school about what classes I was taking, trouble. If the teachers would have talked to the coaches, trouble. If my girlfriend had talked to my other girlfriend, big trouble. You know, and that's called conscious separation. I didn't know that it takes a whole lot of energy to live life like that, keeping everybody separate. And you got to drink an awful lot to fall asleep, even though I don't recognize that. I got here, you know, and I wanted to know, for those new folks, I was like, what is the AA approved, like, sleeping pill? All I want to do is fall asleep, you know. It's not that I want to drink anymore, but I do know that about five bourbons, I will go down for some time. You know, I could just sleep. It'll just give me some. What do you all take? Seriously, what's the AA thing? And they said, well, you know, in AA, we take the 12 steps because a clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. And I'm thinking like, ugh, you know. But that was the deal. It wouldn't have been nice to know back then because my conscience was anything but clear. By my senior year, I'd switched from the green stuff to the white stuff. It was a lot more money. I'm driving a silver BMW convertible. It's got a number on the back for you BMW people. Lets you know that they don't make or sell this model in the United States. It's a European one. I had to have it shipped here on a boat because I'm that important. I purchased my first house, 423 Nautilus Street. It's the fourth house on the right at Winded Sea Beach. One of the best surf spots in the world, but I don't surf anymore. Because I drink. When you drink like I drink, everything must go. Every hobby, every passion, every deep-seated joy from deep within that brings me any genuine satisfaction in life, all of those things have to go when I drink. That's all I do. Real hard to get up early in the morning when that wind's offshore and the birds are flying by and the dolphins are going by and God's saying good morning when you drink like I drink. And I'm living in that house in La Jolla, and I'm driving that car, and I'm dating the prettiest girl at the college, or at least that's what you all thought, so I dated her. I still don't know if I liked her. And it was about 5:30 in the morning, and boom, boom, boom. Every single door and window came in that house, and the next thing you know, I had those plastic zip ties on that are worse than the handcuffs, and they take me off to MCC, the Metropolitan Correction Center in downtown San Diego. It's a federal penitentiary. And my mother was nice enough, the Union Tribune, she kept one for me. It said, Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine, was a headline. The federal sentencing guidelines, I don't know if anybody's familiar with those. Judges don't even have a whole lot of choice in what they do. Turns out that all those, if you pulled my NCIC, the criminal history thing, I've got a whole bunch of really stupid arrests, about 36 of them to be exact. They're all like, and I don't want anybody in here to think I'm any gangster. It should just say drunk and stupid, right? Because it's all like, you know, open container, drunk in public, failure to obey a lawful command, right? That's a big one. And if anybody with authority, you ask me to do anything, I'm going to do the opposite, right? Steve and I are just settling up a bar tab out front, you know, just figuring out who's going to pay tonight. You know what they call that? Second degree assault. I mean... There's people I don't get along with well, you know, to this day, just police and prosecutors and judges. They don't seem to get us, and they just take stuff so serious, you know. I mean, just we're figuring out the bar tab, second degree assault. And these guidelines, they look at, like, the number of times you've been arrested and then the amount of stuff and boom. And, you know, mine said 46 to 60 years, and I'm thinking 46 to 60 years, that's, you know, I'm the first to confess, you know, I've seen some pretty tough-looking dudes running around this conference. I'm a jail guy. I am not a prison guy. I specialize in, like, 60-day sentences a year, 90 days, you know, I'll do 9 months. You know, that's fine. You'd give me a lot of those. What I didn't really realize I was too dumb to pick up that I was really serving a life sentence on the installment program. But I thought I was doing pretty good avoiding prison, and here I am in this federal penitentiary. I wasn't given any bond. It was one of the first things that did capture my attention. They said that if U.S. attorney stood up, man, you know how they are. And he says, if Mr. Brucker is given any bond whatsoever, he'll flee to Mexico to live with his business partners where he will have a happy and successful life. Those words kind of got me here. You know, it was the opposite of all that other stuff. I'm like, happy and successful life, and they're looking to kill me. I haven't been happy and successful in Baltimore. I hadn't been happy and successful when my parents retired to Ocean City. I hadn't been happy and successful in Pacific Beach. I hadn't been happy and successful when I bought a house in Lloyd. Happy and successful. What are they talking about? And I was starting to clue in. My spirit was quite literally starting to awaken to the fact that wherever I go, there I am, and I'm not happy anywhere. And inside that, you know, the judge bought it, and I wasn't given any bond. So I'm sitting in there, and what I now know is this power that we talk about that brings us together. And when I say God, I have a very short time this morning or this afternoon to tell you all what you all have given me. And when I say that word, I'm talking about whatever pops in your head. I hope the semantics of language, it's the best we have to communicate. I'll tell you a quick story. When I was like 9 or 10 months sober, they made the mistake of calling on me in an 11-step meeting and, you know, saying like, everybody was sharing about God of their understanding, and they call on the new guy, and I'm going, I don't believe in any of that, you know, God, blah, blah, blah. But I will tell you this. I'm a surfer, and I know that waves are energy that travel thousands of miles across the ocean in a certain direction, and if the sandbar or the reef faces a certain direction at the right time of day, and the tide is exactly right, because a wave will only break in half the depth of the size of the wave, and the wind is also going perfectly offshore, which I can't make happen, and that happens while the tide is right, and the wave hits half the depth of the size of the wave, and all that's happening, I can't make all that happen, so I'll concede that there's some power out there that makes all that happen. And one of the old timers said, hey, well, thanks for sharing, but you just took up 20 minutes of our meeting. We just call that God. It's got 3 letters, it's real quick, and we all know what you mean. So whenever I say that three quick letters, that's what I'm talking about, the thing that makes those waves and the wind and whatever you think's happening out there as well. So I hope that word brings us together, not apart. And what I now know is this power put me in there and surrounded me with enough of me that I was able to see me for the first time. And these guys told stories like why they were in there that were stories that I could relate to because I told them my whole life. Why are you in here? Well, I'm in here because of my mechanic. And if my mechanic had fixed my taillight correctly, that cop would have never pulled me over. If the cop wouldn't have pulled me over, he'd have never smelled the alcohol on my breath. If he hadn't smelled the alcohol on my breath, wouldn't have pulled me out of the car, ended up arresting me, searched the trunk, incident to arrest, and found the dope. So you can see that the reason I'm in here is because of my mechanic. And when I get out of here, if I ever find that mechanic, he's going to get it. And if you hook that guy up to a lie detector, he would pass it. Because that's what we have. Our book speaks of delusion, right? And that's believing the very story we tell. Very different than denial, a word which our book does not use. Denials, I just take your purse, you say, did you take it? And I go, no, and I know darn well I took it. And that lie detector's going, boop, 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 boop. I know I'm lying, I'm just denying it. But delusion, you say, did you take my purse? And I say, no, I didn't, ma'am, may I help you look for it? And that lie detector goes, psh. Doesn't even budge. And that's a form of mental illness, by the way. But I was offended when I got to step two about what you might be suggesting. Guy told me he was in there because of what his wife did. And if his wife hadn't done what she did, he wouldn't have had to do what he did to her. And, you know, if he gets out of there and gets this straightened out with his wife, you know, that it was very clear why he stabbed her. And I'm going, wow, you know, this is me. I've got an excuse for everything. And what happened to me was I was able to, just this inner thing happened where I was able to see things different. And I clued into the fact that I was where I was because of who I was. And I was who I was because of how I live. And I'm going to repeat that because it's maybe the biggest deal that happened in my life. And we're real big on that in AA. I was where I was because of who I was. I was who I was because of how I live. In other words, my tombstone is not going to say, here lies Rich Bruckner. He meant well. Because I always meant well. I don't know about you. There was never a Friday night when I was taking that pregame shower, you know, getting in there, that beer's up there in the shower and it's trickling down and the hot water's hitting you, and I get out and I put a silk shirt on and spray on a little of that girl sauce because it's going to be a good night. You know, and Roger says, what are you up to tonight, Rich? And I go, well, Roger, did I say that? I'm going to go out and I'm going to humiliate my mother to where she can't look me in the eyes for the next decade. What are you up to tonight, buddy? Jay says, what are you up to tonight, Rich? Well, Jay, tonight's the night I'm going to go out and shame my little sister to where she doesn't speak a single word to me for 6.5 years. You got any plans? I never left the house wanting or meaning for any of that stuff to happen, but it's what happened. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you all hold me to the same principle. You guys could care. Trust me, the guys I sponsor could care less that I'm here at the South Bay Roundup having a great time hanging with you all. They're wondering if I'm going to be on time to make the coffee. Am I going to be there one Monday night when they come to read at the table at my house? Am I going to be there to do the next step with them? Am I going to be there at the jail? You know, they're watching. You all, nobody's ever pulled me aside. None of you old timers. I got so many here that are my ear. None of you. One thing I've never heard from any of you is, hey, Rich, what do you think about our book? You know, you got any opinion? I mean, is it well written? Are the steps properly numbered? You have any updates for us? You all care very little about what I think. You care what I do. And it turns out the whole rest of the world is like that. I'm judged on my actions, not my intentions. That was a huge deal for me. I sit in that penitentiary for 9 months and 1 week. We're coming up just before the trial. It turns out that the DEA agents had some problems of honesty of their own on the affidavit to get the search warrant. The search was determined to be illegal. The drugs were suppressed, and they had to drop the trial, and I walked out. You would think I walked out a free man, but anybody in here that's ever been in the penitentiary knows you're not free when you get out. You know what you are? Thirsty. And when alcohol owns you lock, stock, and barrel, and I can't stay where I am, and I can't go home because I've shamed that good family. Good and for all. The ego would not let me return to show face. I don't know if I could have or not, but the ego wouldn't have allowed it. And I start bouncing around because I can't stay here. And I go to a town called Ketchum, Sun Valley, Idaho. And I stay there as long as I can before I go to Boulder, Colorado. And I stay in Boulder as long as I can before I go to Steamboat. I'm like a man without a country. But meanwhile, you know, I stay where I am until they come. Because there's always a warrant when I drink. I never do anything decent. I've never had any reports the next day of, my gosh, last night you were out in front of that Vaughn so drunk and you were helping little old ladies push their garbage. You were unloading groceries. You were walking them across. I mean, that was fantastic what you were doing last night. I've never gotten any of those reports. When I get a warrant, I run because tough guys stay and face the music. Inside, I'm a coward that wants you to think I'm a tough guy. When I get a warrant, I run. So I often create a worse situation. You know, my solutions are usually worse than the problem would have been to begin with. And as I go, I'm a man on the run, and if I ran into any of the women that I've, you know, seen around here this weekend, and, you know, I'm sitting on a bar stool at the Million Dollar Cowboy Bar in Jackson, Wyoming, and I buy you a drink with some money that's probably not mine or certainly not legally earned, and you say, so, what's your story? I look at you and say, traveling, babe, just traveling. Like I'm some type of romantic sojourner across our great country, you know? And I'm like one step ahead of the law, but it's so delusional, you know?
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And I end up eventually where all big shot, tough guy, wannabe drug dealers wind up when the federal government seizes every bank account, car, house, and everything else you have. I wind up back on my mom's couch in Ocean City, Maryland. And there's a lot of people smiling and laughing at that, which tells me there's some mom's couch people here. And it's a great place to start the journey. And there's only, you know, I couldn't even believe this woman took me back into her house. Couldn't even believe it. And there's only one rule at mom's house. You all know it, right? You can stay here as long as you want, as long as... Oh, yeah, we got mom's couch, people. As long as you don't drink. And that's it. And I was never, ever, ever, ever going to drink. And if you'd have hooked me up to that lie detector, I'd have passed. And that lasted 2.5 weeks. And I'm out there, and I start bopping in and out of your meetings. I've been sending you folks here for long enough as the big counselor, because it turns out there's no chapter in our book called In the Knowing. I can tell you more about the disease of alcoholism than anybody cares to know, all about the Jelinek curve and the liver and the pancreas' processing of alcohol to a simple sugar while I'm dying, right? Know all about it, dying of it. I start coming in and out of the meetings. They're not doing much I go to, guys are saying things, they're patting me on the back and saying, put the plug in the jug, kid. That's what we do around here. We just don't drink. You know, just put the plug in the jug, see you at the next meeting, you know, and don't drink between meetings. And all we just don't drink and, you know, go to meetings. I'm like, wow, that is brilliant. I mean, that's the best you got. Don't drink equals sir. I mean, I never thought to try that, sir. That is, thank you. I mean, thank you. Good God. I'd have never come up with that. You know, and guess what? If I could do that, I'm not alcoholic. You know, by definition. And I'm looking at those meeting schedules, and you know what? I'm all messed up in my head. And in Maryland, I don't know what it looks like here. Your meeting list is probably a million times bigger than ours. But my little area, Monday night, it says Monday night meetings. Open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, step study. Tuesday night, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, step study. Wednesday night, open discussion, speaker meeting, open discussion, big book study. I could go on and on. You get the point. And with these meetings, you know, there's some of them I go in and they're talking about the book and stuff. So if I go into one of those, they usually have the book right up front. If I see that, I get out because there's a spiritual principle called water seeks its own level. You know, you're drawn to that which you are and sick like sick. So I like these discussion meetings, right? They're for me. And I go into them and it's usually like, you know, anybody have a topic? And Franny raises her hand and they call on Franny and Franny says, you know, my cat Trinket I've had for 17 years and Trinket passed away last night. And she starts crying. She tells us all about Trinket and I've had such great times with Trinket over the years. And Trinket and I, when I used to knit, Trinket would cuddle right up next to me and she would purr next to me while I was knitting. And she goes on and then Franny calls on Thelma. And Thelma too was a pet owner. It's incredible. And she talks about her Yorkshire Terrier that passed away. And they're relating and an hour goes by. And I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of the fatal progressive disease of alcoholism in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I leave, I know no more about recovery from that disease than the second I walked in. Maybe I'm a better pet owner. Maybe I'm a better pet owner. My favorite topic was Bob, you got a topic for us? Oh, Bob always had the same topic. She left me again. She left. And then Bob shares his sage alcoholic relationship advice with us, right? And then he calls on Mark, who's on his fourth wife. And Mark enlightens us a little bit before calling on Margaret. Margaret's been married and divorced, married and divorced, married and divorced from the same guy three times. She knows a lot. She helps us out. You know, and then we go around the room and an hour passes. And I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous dying of the fatal disease of alcoholism, knowing no more about recovery from that than the second I walked in the door, but maybe I'm a better dater. And there's this one woman that I hate more than anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name's Janine. And Janine always has the book with her. She's 18 years sober when I met her. Always got that book with her and the stupid smile and the eye thing. You know, you all got it. And and what really bothers me, you know, I'm thinking like 18 years sober, the book in every meeting, haven't you read that thing yet? And like, are you simple? And what really bothers me about her, she doesn't call her sponsees. She doesn't call them pigeons like they used to in the old days. She calls them duckies. And like, that's enough to make me vomit, right? And she comes into the meeting and sits down and dish, 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 dish. The like six duckies filing in back and all sit down right in line. And then at the end of our meetings, they do this thing. I don't know if they do it here or not, where you get like 10 seconds. If you're up to a year, you know, does anybody have 30 days, 60 days, you know, going up to a year and you get like 10 seconds to say, hey, you got 30 days. And I'm just returning to you from performing a residential burglary on my mother. Because that's who tough guys rob, by the way. I've seen some of you this weekend. I'm not coming into your house, sir. You might hurt me. But tough guys, they rob mom. And my mom, she's a retired school teacher with a real modest little pension. First grade, she could tell you exactly how many kids she's taught to read in her lifetime, and it's in the thousands. And she sleeps in a house with a restraining order against her son, with the door deadbolted and her little purse under her bed. And at 3 o'clock in the morning when the terror and madness were on, I was on my stomach doing my best commando crawl, as quiet as I can, across my mom's bedroom floor. And I reach under the bed for that purse. And her eyes come off the side of that bed, and she catches me dead square in the eye and said, "Rich, take it. Would you just take it?" And I've had some stuff happen in my life, in the places I've been, and I've been stabbed in Panama, beat up plenty of places, locked up plenty of places. And you can beat me up and you can lock me up, but don't you give up on me, Mom. When Mom gives up, man, it hits here. And she didn't really give up. It felt like that to me, because moms don't ever give up. They love you to the end. But I pushed my mother to a place where she just had to be done. Because that's the type of alcoholic I am. And the more that you love me, and the more that you care about me, and the closer you are to me, the more I suck you dry. I'll take every last penny. I will turn that last hair on your head gray and not care. A little pension, let's drain it. We heard that sucking noise, man. That was the sound of my life. Anybody that was anywhere near me was just, you know, I was just going to suck you dry of every bit of emotional well-being you have. And then I'm going to come to you and say, "You know what? I just leave me alone. I only hurt myself when I drink. This is my life. Let me live it." Right? The big lie every alcoholic tells. And Janine with these things, you know, and I'm in the back coming off of a new burglary, and I'm sitting in the back with my hat on, because I was still, you know, I didn't know that you don't wear hats in churches or in buildings at that point in my sobriety. So I got my tough guy hat on, and I'm doing my jail thing, and you got to be pissed, you know. And I'm looking at, then they're coming to that point in the meeting, "Does anybody have 30 days sober?" You know, and Rebecca comes prancing to the front of the room. "Hi, my name's Rebecca. I have 30 days sober. Janine's my sponsor. I'm writing my fourth and fifth step. I think I'm getting free." You know, and I'm in the back. And honest to God, when I'm thinking sober and alcohol, I'm thinking, I'm going to knock her teeth right down her throat. I will knock that smile right off her face. I will knock it off her face. "Does anybody have 60 days? Trish comes running up. "I'm Trish. I've got, Janine's my sponsor. I'm on the ninth step. I'm making amends. My family's coming back together." And I'm in the back. I'm going to knock it right off your face. And then we get to my favorite part of the meeting, right? "Does anybody have 24 hours or a desire to start over?" And I do the longest walk in Alcoholics Anonymous one more time. One more time. So that's what you're looking at. You know, you can thank Dave, you know, good work getting a speaker, you know. I'm like the AA loser. I got more of those 24-hour chips, you know, than I care to admit. And I made it to 36 days without a drink. I'd also had my liver biopsied at 29. I was showing fatty spots in my liver. And I wasn't to take any Tylenol for a year, certain other medications, and I was to eat right. And if I ate the way the doctor told me, he told me my liver would heal. At 36 days without a drink, I couldn't go one more day without a drink. And I couldn't take so much as one more drink. I knew that. And I'd already told you I'm a coward, so you know what I did. I took as many Tylenol and everything in that medicine cabinet I could. I just wanted to check out. And when my body fell, I don't have a good explanation for what happened next, but my neighbor reports that she heard a tremendous thud, because I lived in a crappy apartment. That's where drunks live. And when I fell, I hit the refrigerator, and the refrigerator hit into that thin wall when my body gave out. What I now know is she had a perfect attendance record at work. She hadn't missed a day's work in over 9 years. And on that Tuesday, she was home sick. And that thud into the wall scared the daylights out of her. The lady ran around front, looked through the front door, and she saw feet in the kitchen. She dialed 911. I woke up at PRMC Hospital, where I'd been in four times prior that year due to alcohol. And when I woke up, statistically, there's one or two of you in here that know what I'm talking about. I'm foggy and I'm coming to, and things are beeping and I'm hooked up to all kinds of things. And I realize that I can't even kill myself right. That there's a place just below loser for those of us who can't even kill yourself right. You know, I can screw that up. And as my eyes clear, the things are beeping. I'm in one of those sexy paper hospital gowns that your butt hangs out. They're very good for the self-esteem. And y'all know who I see at the foot of the bed. Janine with the ducks. Now, I don't know if there's a place called Alcoholic Hell or not, but if there is, I think I was there. And Janine did not talk to me that day. Janine had tried to talk to me many times prior. She talked to the duckies and she said, "Girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls." And that was it. Something inside me snapped, man. And when I got into this book with a sponsor and read Bill's story, I mean, Bill got that beautiful white light and the breeze. And I got Janine and the duckies. I mean, it just didn't seem right. But it turned out that it was every bit as wonderful. Because the next thought I had after that, I've never had one like that before or since. And you know what that thought was? If I get out of here alive, if I live through this one, I'm going to find one of those old guys with that book in their hand and that smile on their face. And I'm going to do everything they tell me to do. That's it. And that's exactly what happened. And Jim started me walking me through that book and introduced me to Silkworth. And I call him Silky because he's like my best friend, man. He told me that I'm not a nut, you know, that there is something really going on here. I got a body that can't handle booze coupled with a mind that won't leave it alone. That's a heck of a predicament to be in. And what that looks like for me is when I take so much as one drink, this phenomenon of craving, right, this allergy, once it enters my body, the first drink asks for a second. Second begs for a third. The third demands the fourth. The fourth insists on the fifth, and I want the sixth drink more than I ever wanted the first one. And that never happens in the average or temperate drinker. Answer to that, simple. Don't take the first drink. But it turns out that the other part of this disease, that mental obsession, the thing that always brings me back to that which is killing me. It's good to know. He said, would you agree? He liked to call me Smarty because I'd gone to school and I remembered things. And he'd say, would you agree, Smarty, that powerless means less power? And I'm like, yes, Jim, I'll concede that. He's like, well, what about the second part of the step? Unmanageable. Can you think of any decision that you've made, Rich, time and time and time again in your life? Can you just offer one up? Is there any decision you could think of that you've made over and over and over again? Well, yes, Jim, then I'm never, ever, ever going to drink again. He said, how are you doing managing that decision? He said, that's what I am, and that's what you're looking at today. 11 years later, you know, to today. So far this morning, I've been in your ocean. My mom has called. My little sister's called. What you've given them is nothing short of phenomenal. The calls have been coming in all morning because you're looking at a guy that knows one thing about himself, and that's probably it that really matters, and that's that I have less power than is required to manage my own best decision to never take another drink. And you all offered me the rest of your program. You said, that's a pretty bad position, but the rest of our book's about getting power. That's what this program's all. It's a getting power program. You're not going to hear me. I'm not one of the guys running around and, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. My book talks about getting power and being given the power to help where no one else can, to quite literally being given the power to help save the life of another alcoholic. It's not mine. We got to be real clear on that. But my job's to get clean enough where it can come in and out. And sometimes I want to shirk that responsibility by saying things like, well, nothing I can do. God's going to get him sober or he's not. You know? And I think I do that when I'm you know, scared or tired or lazy or don't feel like going the extra mile. But that's what my book tells me, man, that it's a getting power program to help when no one else can. And we started going on and through that inventory, and we said that, you know, third step prayer, that it was the third step prayer. He said, it's a decision to do the rest of the steps. That's it. We didn't get all heavy on God. He said, why would we do that? If your 11th step God looks anything like your third step God, you might have missed something in between, right? Like, why? None of you really cared what I thought about God at step three. It was a mess. Obviously, I was on step three. I just walked through your door. He told me I'd already come to believe in a wonderful power called Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. He said, how come time after time after time after time you come back to us? How come you don't go to one more rehab? You seem to like those. How come you don't go to one more detox? How come you don't go to one more shake and bake joint? How come you don't go to one more therapist? You love paying them in lion. Why do you keep coming here? Tough question to answer, except for the fact that when I'm with you, for that 1 hour, I knew that there was something magically undefinable about what happened here. And something inside me connected with something inside you that said that there was some kind of solution here. Because the best I know, I don't know if they do it, anybody sitting here, you didn't get court ordered to the South Bay Roundup. They might send you to a meeting, but not to a roundup. If you're here, you're here because you want to be. And something inside me told me there was a solution here. We did that inventory, man, and it turned out there was only one guy that had something to do with everything, and you're looking at him. And either It just became, there was overwhelming evidence in my own handwriting, and that's the worst part, you know, about where the problem lied. And I was never going to do the four step, because if you do what I did for a little, I mean, that's the first rule of business. And you all called it an inventory. I call it a paper trail, right? I mean, I've got, when I'm working with you in my first year, I got warrants in three states. I got the IRS looking for me. And you all want me to write stuff down. I mean, you don't write anything down in my business. I just got out of the federal penitentiary. I'm not going back. But you all are all jazzed up on it, right? You're saying things like, it holds the key to the future, right? And, we do this stuff. And he was getting a little bit older. He passed me to this guy named Roger. And we went through six and seven and had that list in eight. We had it, when we made inventory. And I would tell Jim, I'd report back what I heard to Jim and Roger. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Aren't we supposed to, I live at the beach like you guys do. And I'd come back from the meeting and I'd say, well, we just did, aren't we supposed to do the fifth step down at the beach? And I heard at the meeting, you do it at the beach and you light it on fire and you send it out into the ocean and it's spectacular. And it's like a Viking funeral kind. I mean, it just sounded awesome. And they would go, oh my God, where did you go? That's your eighth and ninth step. No, we're not setting anything on fire. How are you going to do step eight and nine? Where is that in the book? What meeting? Would you please stop going to BB meetings? And I said, what's BB? And he goes, I don't know, but it's not AA. And he took the meeting list and he would circle new meetings. And this thing was starting to happen in me, Where Roger said, the ninth step, kid, the ninth step, Alcoholics Anonymous, all the way up to step nine. It's a theoretical program. He said, nobody out there in the world cares that you've come to some peace with a God of your understanding in steps one, two, and three. Good for you. They don't care. Nobody cares that you've written a whole bunch of inventory and shared it with your sponsor in four and five. It could list some defects and shortcomings in six and seven. Good for you. Nobody cares. Nobody cares that you got a list of what you're going to make right. You've been going to make right your whole life. But step nine is where you get the opportunity, kid. You get to rub the record clean. How free do you want to be? This is where it comes, kid. Maybe, just maybe, I get to die with the left hand and the right hand column on that slate even. He said, if I was you, I'd start dating your mother. Wherever that lady will go with you, you go once a week and take your mother on a date. And I'm working at a little picture frame shop, sweeping the floor where they carve picture frames. And I'm listening to these tapes of some of the people in this very room today. And I'm sweeping that floor and I'm making $6.25 an hour. And I always got a dollar for the basket. And I always got a little money at the end of the week to take my mom on our date. And I'm listening to those guys and I'm listening to those guys and I'm listening to those guys. And some things are starting to happen. I don't know if any of you could relate to this, but some of those meetings I didn't used to like, I was starting to love them. Some of those people I was scared of, I was strangely drawn to them. Some of the people I did really like, I was starting to keep a little healthy distance. Something inside me was becoming inwardly rearranged, right? And I'm drawn to different things and different meetings, and those step meetings were becoming exciting. And dinner after dinner after dinner, and we were at Carrabba's one night, and my mom was eating spaghetti, and I'll never forget it, because while she was twisting that pasta around, her eyes came up from the pasta and she was looking me eyeball to eyeball for the first time in about a decade, man, mother to son. And we were just talking mother to son the way things are supposed to be. She didn't have to look down anymore. And I started getting to go to her house to take out her trash and to change light bulbs in her kitchen. She was getting into her 70s and couldn't stand on a chair anymore. It used to take me, she has one little light in the kitchen to see where she cooks and eats. And I'm embarrassed to tell you, if that light was out, it would be pitch black in that kitchen. She'd ask me to come change a light bulb. It would take me 2 to 3 weeks to sober up enough to go over and do that. And I'd leave my mother in the dark cooking and eating because I couldn't get there. And not anymore, man, with you folks and this new power that you didn't. I'd be there to, she calls, I'm changing a light bulb. Not a big deal to anybody, but to me and my mom. And then time went on, and I'm going to tell you about some other stuff with this ninth step, but just a little precursor. I had a credit score when I got here, which is whatever you get for like having a social security number. It was like sub-zero. And it was bad. And overall, all of this time, what has my wife and I have just a little over a year ago, year and a half, I think, bought this beautiful house on the water. And it turns out that when those letters comes with the bill in them, when you pay those, your credit score goes up. I know. People, you guys are probably thinking that is amazing. And that's how I felt about it. And there's no really other way to do that, by the way. I checked. I tried everything. The credit, you pay those, credit score goes up. And the house, we love it because we both surf and do all kinds of water stuff. But if you had my mom here today instead of me, when she checked in this morning, she'd tell you her favorite part about that house. And that's that we chose to build a house 1.7 miles from her. And she gets to see her granddaughter about 2 to 3 days a week. On the 28th, 2 days ago, our daughter Isabella was 14 months old, so she's a little over a year. Isabella is an old Spanish queen's name, but when we research names, it comes from the Spanish. It quite literally translates to God's precious gift. And that's what she's, been to a guy. I mean, we just celebrated back in June, 3 years of marriage, we're in our fourth year of marriage. I never thought I'd be married. And it's just been an amazing, amazing ride. And my mom, after those amends, I said, what else can I do and what can I make right? And is there anything that, I'm missing? And I kind of leave that door open at the end of the amend because I don't always know what it is. The other person knows what it is. And I thought it was the money and all the stuff I'd stolen and the time and the hairs I turned gray. And my mom started crying and she said, there is another thing I need to talk to you about. What I want to know is, all through high school and all through college, you were never here on the weekends. You always stayed out at your buddy's house, other places. You just from Friday to Sunday, I never saw you. And my mom might be 20 pounds overweight. And she started crying and said, is the reason that I never met any of your friends and any of your girlfriends because you're ashamed of me because I'm fat? I'd have never thought of that. And I got to tell her, and I want to tell you about a freedom. I started crying. I said, Mom, that is so far from it, man. That is so far. You and Dad were good parents. We weren't allowed to drink and drug here. There were other parents that let us put our car keys in a bowl, and as long as we did that, we could drink and do whatever we wanted at their house. That's why I was there, so that I could drink. I've never been ashamed of you. You're the best mother I could have ever. And the look on her face, you could see 50 pounds of weight drop off her shoulder, that I wasn't ashamed of her. And the amend for that is my home group benefits. She knows every one of my home group members. She's the cookie mom. She comes in, she'll be at my anniversary. She doesn't stay for the meeting. She comes a half hour early and mingles with everybody. She just wants to know who her son's friends are. When I was dating Lauren, I introduced her. I let her weigh in. I'm thinking of asking her to marry me, Mom. What do you think? Including her in my life, letting her be a mom. The last thing I want to say about that, and I'll leave it alone, is my whole life I wanted to be a tough guy. I just wanted to be a man. I want you to think I was a man. And it turns out that it's real hard to be a man without first learning how to be a son. I'll leave that being. My sister, I hadn't spoken to in 6.5 years. I had a set of Baltimore Ravens season tickets. I don't know why I had them when I got sober. You know how we're like in a homeless shelter with a hefty bag and I got you. And you're laughing, but there's somebody here on scholarship walking around with an iPhone 6. I guarantee it. That's how we are. You go to the homeless shelter, they got an iPhone 6. And I'm like, you don't have a house, you don't have a bank account, but you got a better phone. Why do you have the latest phone? Because that's how we are. Our priorities are so jacked up. And he said, send those tickets to your sister. She lives in Baltimore. She'd enjoy the games. And I said, perhaps you haven't listened. She don't speak to me. These are expensive. And he said, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, send them to your sister. And I sent them and nothing happened. He said, send the next set of tickets. And I did. And the phone rang, and it was a Sunday, of course, and when that phone rang, there was a little girl's voice on the other, Richie, did you see that? They just threw the ball. The Ravens tied it up. They tied the game. The ball's in, blah, blah, blah. She said, there was nothing less I could have cared anything about than that Ravens game. But I was talking to my little sister, man, for the first time in 6.5 years, and I kept sending those tickets and having those little conversations around football, which she wanted to talk about. And on the weekends for my little job, I upgraded, by the way. That sweep, it turned out, it got me a job vacuuming swimming pools. And that was like a, big upgrade in my career path. And I got paid $500 a week. I couldn't even believe it. And I'm paying the IRS back some money. I owed the IRS about $37,000. They set me up on a $20 a week payment program. I have no idea how you pay back $37,000, 20 bucks. I mean, I had a plan for the IRS, right? You guys might have had the same plan, right? When I get $37,000, I'm going to pay them back. Problem is, we never have $37,000. I can tell you, I don't know whether them or anybody else on the face of the entire earth a penny as I stand here today. They're in a place I can't go. When I put that last check in the mailbox to the IRS, my little sponsor Roger with his pacemaker jumped up over that mailbox and gave me a high five. He looked like Jordan. And I was like, easy, with the pacemaker. And he said, say it to the mailbox. And I'm in front of the post office where everybody can. I said, my amends to the IRS is complete. And I put it in there. And about a year went by and I got this envelope. And inside the envelope was all this stuff and a big check. And I knew I was in trouble. I got really upset. I drove a half hour to his house. And I said, Raj, I've screwed something up. They're after me again, I think. They sent this check. And he looked through it. And he said, that's a tax refund check, dummy. Normal people get those every year. And I have for like the last decade. I send them the money. I don't have to agree with it. They send me a refund. That's pretty good. And after some time went by, this guy called me and I knew him. He said, Rich, this is Justin. That was my little sister's boyfriend. And he said, you know, I know your father's no longer with you and a part of your lives, but you've become the number one man in your little sister's life. I'm calling to ask you for her hand in marriage. And there ain't anybody less qualified to give away the hand of a beautiful little girl than the lousy brother that stands before you. And she called the next day and asked if I'd walk her down the aisle. And I got to do that, a sober man of integrity, with my head up and my shoulders back and a little bit of dignity back that you folks gave me. My little sister now has two little boys, 2.5 and 1. And we're always in the same room at the same time. She lives very close. And our kids get to play and they're going to grow up together, getting to be together because Alcoholics Anonymous has repaired our family. The last thing I had as I'm going, well, I had this guy, Ethan, as we're going down that 9-step list. And Ethan and I were best friends since this big, and he asked me to be the best man in his wedding when I was out in La Jolla taking over the world one drug deal at a time. And his father sent me a plane ticket that he paid for, a tuxedo. All I had to do was get on the plane and be the best man in the wedding. And I was so excited to do that I started drinking the night before. And y'all know how that went. I didn't get on that airplane. When I do something like that, you go on a secret list of people I can't talk to anymore. And when you call me and that caller ID goes off and I see your name, my stomach gets tight and sick, especially sober, tight and sick. And if you have to look at caller ID before you answer the phone, you're living in bondage of self. Talk to your sponsor about that. I don't have time. But I will tell you, there are people in the room that when they call me, I get to answer the phone today. Hello, Rich Bruckner. And that is a tremendous freedom because it no longer matters who's on the other end. No longer matters. And whenever Ethan would call, I would get sick because I knew why he was calling to tell me I was a no-good drunken bum. And I heard his wife was lovely, and I'd heard they had a child and another child over the years. And I knew he told them what a bum I was. And I called and said, I'm in this thing called AA. We got a thing called the 9th step. I need 5 minutes of your time. Maybe your father could be there. I know I screwed your wedding up, and I'm a lousy friend. But this is a life-or-death deal, buddy. If you could give me 5 minutes to try to straighten this out, I'd really appreciate it. He said, yeah, you could be here at 7 a.m. on Saturday if you can make it. And that was about 9 years later. So I think he might have had one of those resentment things. And I showed up with a pile of money in my pocket from doing the swimming pools. And I knocked on the door, and his father's car was in the garage. And when he opened the door, his mother and father were standing in the back. His wife was by the kitchen counter holding the daughter's hand, and Ethan opened the door, and what I didn't see, this little boy came running at me like a freight train, man, from the other room, and he came running right at me, and he grabbed a hold of my leg like a tree trunk, and he looked up in my eyes, and he said, you're my Uncle Rich? Daddy said one day I'd meet you. And just like that, I had an inward knowing, nothing you taught me or convinced me of. The scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. And I realized that I'm what separates me from you. My stupid ego, my inability to admit that I've done something wrong, to say the words, man, I was wrong. My ego separates me from you, and the problem with that is when I'm separate from you, I'm separate from God, and it's just that way. I did my amends in the other room with his father afterwards, and his father said, you owe me $1,372. And I didn't see that coming either, and I reached in my pocket to pay him. And he said, you're not going to pay me if you're really in this AA thing, no more than $10 at a time. You're going to go to a meeting. You're going to take coffee, take some fancy coffee every now and then, take some donuts, put gas in a newcomer's car so that they can get to the next meeting. Don't give them the money. Put the gas in their car. When you have $1,372 of $10 or less receipts, you will bring them back to me, and on that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, I'm 28 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been praying for the two of you. My home group ate Stouffer's lasagnas for the better part of 3 years. They're $9.95. And they enjoyed the heck out of them. And the last, I owed the state of California 5 years of my life. I had an outstanding warrant that I ran away from. My sponsor said, this is a good time to go serve that 5 years. I didn't think that way, but sponsors see things different. And my home group took me to the airport, and I was scared to death, and I turned myself in and walked in front of the judge. And what I didn't know was that 47 of you took time to write that judge letters and tell him what my life looked like and meetings I was going to and people I was helping and floors I was mopping. And that judge said something. I stood there. He said, what do you have to say for yourself? And I said, nothing, Your Honor. You told me what to do on probation. I violated it. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't ever want to have to take another drink. I'd like to just serve those 5 years so that I could be free. And he said, that's not what these people say. And he started going through your letters. Reading your letters to me in a courtroom. And then he said something to me that no judge had ever said. He said, you didn't complete this the way that I told you to, but you did complete this. This case is dismissed. And I've been arrested 36 times, and I've gone to jail 36 times. That was a big deal. I stepped out in the hallway. I said, Roger, Roger, I'm coming home. Tell the guys we can still have the big book meeting in my house on Wednesdays. They don't have to. We can still. I'm coming home. And he said, well, wait a second, buddy. You got to buy a plane ticket for tomorrow, right? It's only like 1 o'clock in the air. I said, yeah. He said, well, what about that Jesuit school that kicked you out? Isn't that out there somewhere? And I'm thinking like, well, good God, can we have a moment of celebration? You know? But they're like that, these sponsors. You know, work and more work. They're always quoting stuff. And I went over there, and it seemed like small potatoes after going to prison for 5 years, you know. And I sat down, and wouldn't you know, it was the same dean that kicked me out, still there all those years later. I said, I don't know if you remember me. My name's Rich Bruckner. I used to go to school. She said, we remember you, Rich. We've only had one student go to the federal penitentiary. And I told her I now knew what the Jesuits were, and I didn't stand for what they stood for, and I know what harm I did to that school. So I brought a great deal of shame with those articles in the newspaper, and that I had no idea how to make it right. I knew the Jesuits stood for building men and women of integrity and education and doing the right thing. How can I make this right? And she said, if that's true, come with me. And she walked me to a building I've never been in, and she slid me a huge stack of papers and said, fill out these papers. This is an application to our law school. We want you to go to our law school. We want you to graduate and make us proud. That's how you're going to make this right. Believe it or not, we don't like to kick people out. What makes us look good is graduating, so having a high graduation rate and alumni that do good things. So that's what you're going to do. And I stepped outside and I called Roger. I said, the dean, yes, I made the amends. She's lost her mind. She wants me to do this. She wants me to fill out that. I've been arrested 36 times. I'm a federal felon. Even if I go to law school and somehow pass, which we all know that I won't, I'll never pass the bar exam. If I do pass the bar exam, they'll never let me take through the ethics committee. If I do that, they'll never let me practice law. But he said, shut up. Did you just tell that lady you'd do whatever she said to make it right? And I said, yes, I did. He said, then shut up and fill out the papers. 3 years later, I graduated second from the top of my class, not because I'm smart. I did law school the AA way. I showed up 15 minutes early for every class. I shook every teacher's hand every day until they knew my name. I stayed a half hour after class asking questions about what we learned that day, whether I really needed to or not, just what we do with the newcomer to build the relationship. It turns out that your principles work wonderfully in every other area of life. I came back to Maryland. As soon as I graduate, I make it through the bar. I do have to go in front of the ethics. It's a lot more complicated than I have time to tell you about. I wish you were there. This ethics committee is like 9 judges, and they're like, we can't figure this out. You've got all these wonderful recommendations and great grades, and over here we got these 36 arrests. And I said, well, Your Honors, I had to disclose in the application process that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how familiar you are with AA, but there's a substantial period of drinking required for membership. And they started laughing like you did. And I sailed through that, and I wasn't through that 30 days that the phone rang. And on the other end of the phone was a guy that introduced himself. He said he was the state's attorney for the state of Maryland. The governor had just given him a large a grant to hire an assistant state's attorney for the state of Maryland to hand up a gang and narcotics prosecution unit that he was given my name that I might know something about importation of narcotics. And my knees about buckled. My knees about buckled. But my next thought was what you old guys with that book in your hand said to me. You said, kid, one day your sordid past will become your greatest asset. And it was hard at first because I've told you how those judges are. They're tricky little son of guns. And they would say things, you know, just to embarrass me, like, will the defendant please rise? I'd stand up and they'd say, no, you're the prosecutor. And I'd sit back down. And, you know, like, I was just used to being the defendant. But I got used to it. And it turns out that they got a real hard time. You know, when I look across that table, somebody else might see an armed robber breaking into a liquor store for a 12-pack of beer. I see somebody much like myself when the morning terror and madness were on, were willing to steal from their mother's slender purse. And I can promise everybody in this room I've come up with some very creative sentencing arrangements in the last 8 years. Because of the way I practice law, which is no different than the way I practice Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and the way that we try to act in our marriage and everywhere else, there is no separation. I was nominated by the Judicial Nominating Committee to be the youngest circuit court judge in the state of Maryland. I wasn't chosen. I wasn't chosen. And I think that I'm where I am right now, where I'm supposed to be. And I just found that out not too long ago. And that's cool with me. I love what I do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the life that you've given me. And it's just one life. There is no longer anything called my AA life, my work life, my romance life, my family life. It's just all one. And it is so much easier to live that way. And every day I get to say two amazing things. Every morning I walk into that courtroom and I get to stand up and say, good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And every night I get to say the way more important thing. I get to come somewhere like this with people with you and say that my name's Rich Bruckner, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for my life, that's all I got.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.